I'm calling about the topic of rent and cost of living. It's completely gotten way out of hand. Rent in my area has increased 18%, which I'm a Florida state employee, and cumulatively for 25 years, the cost of living this year is increased more than all of the cost of living increases I've ever received combined. It's, if anything changes, I'm just going to be homeless. I can't even apply for rent, as most people would like three times the income of the rent, and I make nowhere near that.
Today, we're talking about something that'll resonate with a lot of you.
Rent, it's too damn high.
That was New York politician Jimmy McMillan in 2010, but its words are just as accurate today. New York City holds the top spot for rental costs. It passed San Francisco last year. The median rent for one bedroom in New York is just over $3,200, while you're looking at about $2,800 in San Francisco. But when it comes to whose rent is rising fastest, Austin, Texas is on top. Austin's rental rates for new leases rose 40% over the last year, according to Redfin's Rental Market Tracker. Rents across the country are increasing. According to online apartment rental site Zumper, the median rent for a one-bedroom increased about 12% in 2021 and is now at an all-time high. So why are rents rising now? And what can tenants, landlords, and policymakers do about it? We'll discuss all that and more after the break. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Remember to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app, and leave us a voicemail.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from Yogi T. These days, self-care can feel like just another task on your never-ending to-do list. But finding time for yourself doesn't have to be complicated. In fact, it can be as simple as brewing yourself a cup of Yogi Honey Chai Turmeric Vitality Tea. Step away from the chaos of the day and support your well-being with this delicious blend of turmeric and warming chai spices. Support your well-being with Yogi Tea.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to discussing high rents and affordable housing. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Jenny Schutz. She's a senior fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She's also the author of the new book, Fixer Upper, How to Repair America's Broken Housing Systems. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is Daryl Fairweather. She's a chief economist at Redfin. Daryl, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Jenny, we talked about New York and Austin just a moment ago, but rising rental costs are hitting people hard across the country. Jenny, why are we seeing rents rising so much right now?
What we're really seeing is the collision of both the supply and demand side of housing markets, driving up rents, driving up housing prices. So on the demand side, we have two historically large generations, the millennials and the baby boomers. It's just a lot of bodies, a lot of people who need places to live. Coming out of the recession, we've had very strong growth in income for a lot of households, very strong job market. Those things tend to push up rents because there are just a lot of people who need apartments and are willing and able to pay for it. On the supply side, we've been underbuilding housing for a decade nationally, ever since the Great Recession. New construction of homes has not kept up with the growth in population and jobs, so we don't have enough homes to go around. And in places like Austin and San Francisco and New York, the places with some of the strongest job markets, we've actually been underbuilding housing for more like 30 years. So we have this huge deficit of homes at a time when we need more homes and more people are looking for places to live.
Now, Daryl, you've been tracking rents at Redfin. What has the data shown you?
We're seeing that leases, new rents are up 14% from last year, and this is a big change from last year when rents were only up 3%. During the pandemic, people were pretty much staying in place, especially with the eviction moratorium, and now all of a sudden everybody is out looking for a new place to live, maybe in a new neighborhood or a new city, or looking to move out from roommates or their parents' house, and all that extra demand is driving up prices.
And what else do you think is causing rents to rise? We're talking about people shifting to new housing, a lack of housing stock. Anything else that comes to mind?
Well, there's extra money flowing around in the economy because people didn't have much to spend on during the pandemic. They couldn't go on vacation. They couldn't go out to eat. But where you live is very important to people, especially since we've all been stuck at home for so long. So I think people are especially now looking for a new place to live, maybe with more space, maybe more space for themselves, and that extra demand is driving up rents.
Jenny, how are different regions and different income groups being affected by the increase?
One of the really unusual things about this round of housing market is that we're seeing strong demand in an awful lot of places. It's not just the biggest coastal cities that are seeing high increases. In fact, a lot of the increases are kind of the somewhat smaller Sunbelt cities. So places like Denver and Nashville, Salt Lake City have been particularly strong, in part because people have been leaving New York and San Francisco and moving to places where they can work from home. So we're seeing a pretty broad-based geographic spread of rent increases. We know when it comes to income, there are sort of a couple of interesting trends going on. One of the fastest growing segments of renters is high-income households, people earning more than $75,000 or $100,000 per household, who typically would have been in the homeownership market. Because there's so few homes available for sale, many of those households are staying renters longer than they would have. That's driving the demand for new professionally managed high-end apartments. The people who are really getting stuck, of course, are the ones at the bottom of the income distribution. The poorest 20% of households spend more than half of their income on rent. That leaves them less than $500 to spend on other necessities, which is just unsustainable for most households. They have the fewest choices. There aren't that many apartments at the low end. There's not nearly enough public subsidy to help them. So low-income renters are getting the worst end of the deal.
Well, we did hear from some of you on the landlord side of this issue.
Hello, this is Romain from Roanoke, Virginia. I'm an investor from France. We own a number of properties, residential, multifamily, and commercial. The reason we're going to increase rents, it is because of the cost of maintenance. We're seeing a dramatic increase in the past year in labor costs, as well as material costs, when we can find any materials. And we're going to have to pass on a portion of those through rent increases to our tenants.
My name's Franco from Cleveland. I'm a landlord responding to your prompt asking us for information about rental rates. We've been landlords for a long time in my family, and we try very hard to provide low rents, as low as possible, to regular people. It's good for our business to avoid turnover, and it's good for them to have cheaper rents. But it's becoming impossible not to raise rents. I haven't had to do it yet, but I'm losing money, and that's because cost of water has doubled or tripled. The cost of sewer, the same. The taxes have gone up 20 to 30%. The cost to insure the property has gone up significantly. How can we possibly keep the rent the same? There is no alternative. Rents have to go up eventually, and that is going to cause some serious problems for renters.
Daryl, what more can you tell us about the pressures landlords are facing right now?
Well, the landlords that just spoke said it really eloquently. There's inflation in all parts of the economy right now when it comes to materials, with the material shortages. When it comes to labor, it's very hard to get contractors out. So if you want to get work done, if you want to provide a high standard of living for your tenants, it's expensive to do so, and landlords just have to pass that cost on. I will say, though, that landlords do have the benefit of very low mortgage rates, especially if they were able to refinance in the last year. So I think there are many landlords who are getting a pretty good profit in this market.
Now, Jenny, we're talking about how rates are now at an all-time high, but didn't we see many landlords lower rent during the first year of the pandemic to attract new renters because of a surge in vacancies after people fled some cities?
Yeah, we saw that in some places and in some parts of the market. So particularly in New York, in Manhattan, downtown San Francisco, the kind of core downtown area of a lot of big cities saw people either moving out to the suburbs or a lot of, for instance, 20-somethings who chose not to move to the city or move back in with their parents temporarily. So landlords in those areas were definitely trying to recruit tenants and giving some concessions to move in. But we've seen a reversal of that. All of the people who moved back into their parents' basement have now moved out and gotten an apartment, which has driven up some of the rents there. One of the interesting things, too, is that even in the early part of the pandemic, when rents were softening at the high end of the market, we didn't see a decrease in rents for lower rate apartments. So there really wasn't much softening in the part of the market that really needed it the most. There's almost never going to be a drop in the bottom end of the market because you just hit a floor of operating costs and landlords can't cut the rent.
Well, here's another message we got from one of you.
Rental prices are just outrageous all across the board. Rentals of all kinds are just as much as mortgages. It's ridiculous. And we need the local state government to get involved and put regulations. You know, I understand that the owners collecting the money, making the money, you know, don't care because they're the ones making the money. But for everyone else that has to pay, it matters. And it's ridiculous. They need to step in and put in regulations on prices, rental prices. It's unfair for them, but it's fair. It's fair. It's just getting out of hand, and it's completely and utterly ridiculous. People are working to pay their rent and have no money for anything else.
Jenny, how are housing and rental regulations playing into the rising cost of rent?
They vary a lot across the country. So most parts of the U.S. don't have rent regulations or rent control the way the caller was suggesting, meaning that landlords can essentially raise the rent to match the market. And, you know, we want to distinguish between rental increases that are driven by cost increases to the landlords. So if the landlord is having to pay more for their labor, for instance, for maintenance costs, then they need to pass that on to the tenants or the landlord may not be able to keep the building in service. This is a really touchy issue. Can certainly understand how a lot of renters see their rent going up and think this is all straight profit to the landlord. They're just being greedy. They're asking for a bunch. And in some cases, that may be true. But some of this is also the cost of doing business. What we want to be careful of, if you make it really difficult for landlords to do business and cover their costs, some of them will choose not to be landlords. They may pull the apartment building off of the market, convert it to something else, or even just let it sit empty. So the last thing we want to do is discourage landlords from offering apartments up to rent because that would exacerbate the supply problem.
Can you point to a state that has regulations that approach rent controls or regulations around how much housing can be rented for in a way that makes sense?
So Oregon is trying a new approach. Several years ago, they passed a couple of housing bills at the statewide level. One was a rent regulation that's not as restrictive as many are. So it's, I believe, 6 percentage points over the rate of inflation. So landlords can raise the rent to cover cost of operations, but not to an unlimited amount. At the same time, Oregon also passed some really innovative statewide land use reforms that make it easier to build duplexes, triplexes, small apartment buildings across more parts of the state. So I think for states and cities that are interested in introducing regulations, if you want to pass stronger tenant protections, make sure that that's paired with some sort of a supply increase. Make it easier to build housing so we're addressing the long-term problems as well.
Daryl, you've also been watching the connection between climate change and housing. What are you seeing?
Are you worried about how climate change is going to exacerbate the housing affordability crisis and how the housing affordability crisis will put more people in harm's way at climate change? I think a good example of this is in California. The restrictive zoning in San Francisco has pushed people to move to more inland parts of California, in the woods where wildfire risk is higher. They often move into more single-family neighborhoods, which aren't as environmentally friendly because they're not dense. And it just puts people in harm's way. And I think when we think about the climate crisis, we should be thinking about where are people going to live, where are the safest places for people to live, and what's the most green kind of housing that we can be building. We're in this housing affordability crisis, and I think we need to kind of kill two birds with one stone and think about how we can also reduce the carbon impact of housing as we grapple with climate change.
Jenny, what do you think are some of the biggest impacts climate change will have on affordable housing?
Yeah, there are a couple of areas that are worrying. So one is that low-income people live in places where housing is relatively inexpensive, and that tends to be in places that are at higher risk of climate change. So if you think about a city like Houston, the parts of the city that flood most often are the cheaper places to live, and so you wind up with poor people living in very vulnerable areas where they're more likely to get hit by climate disasters. We also know that newer housing tends to be more energy efficient. It's more likely to have central air conditioning, which is really important as temperatures go up. Because poor people are more likely to live in older buildings, these are often buildings that have higher utility costs and higher maintenance costs. They may have older doors and windows that are not as well insulated. So both the operating costs for the landlord are higher because these aren't energy efficient, and they're also not as comfortable to live in when we get extreme temperature changes. So one of the areas where public policy could help is for federal money to go into some of the cheaper, older apartment buildings and improve the climate resilience. You know, do the window and door replacements, add in insulation, change over the older heating and cooling systems to more energy efficient systems. That makes it a better building for people to live in. The landlords generally can't afford to make those upfront investments, but that also extends the life of the property and keeps some of these cheaper apartments in the housing stock and usable for longer.
We got this email from David in Austin who says, my wife and I own a couple of houses we rent out. To be fair, when renewing a lease, we raise rent based on inflation and not the market. Once someone moves out, we offer the property based on the market value. Our motivation is also to keep reliable renters. Daryl, where do you think rents go from here?
It depends on where inflation goes more broadly in the economy. I think that's something that we're still kind of waiting to see. The Federal Reserve plans on raising interest rates, which should slow down inflation more broadly. But because home prices have gone up so much, I think we're going to see more people stay in the rental market, and we're going to see the sustained demand for rentals. And the underlying problem is really that there isn't enough housing, and we're not going to solve that problem overnight. So I think that there is more room for rents to grow over the next 5 years at least.
So for people who are feeling the pinch, what do they do? What options do they have? Jenny?
I mean, the best strategy is clearly to build a time machine, go back to 1970 and buy some properties in Palo Alto. Mm. Then you're pretty much taken care of. But since that's not going to be a practical option for most renters, it's going to be some combination of trying to find a place that you can live in where you can negotiate a reasonable rent for maybe potentially for a couple of years. Ask your landlord if you can sign a 2-year lease or 3-year lease with a built-in rent increase that you know, so at least you can plan for that. It's also really important for renters to be trying to set aside some of their income every month, whether they wind up using that as a down payment or just to have as a cushion so that they're able to withstand, say, a short-term job loss. You know, it's really important for people to have some liquid savings to fall back on. That's hard when their rent keeps going up, but that's what gives them a little bit more financial security and a little bit more of a cushion.
Jenny's going to stick with us, but we've also been with Daryl Fairweather, the chief economist at Redfin. Daryl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And a reminder to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to discussing high rents and affordable housing with Jenny Schutz. She's a senior fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Fixer Upper, How to Repair America's Broken Housing Systems. ProPublica reporter Heather Vogel has been looking into a new trend of private equity-backed corporations buying apartment buildings across the country. She found skyrocketing rents, unkept facilities, maintenance delays, all in the name of investment. And Heather Vogel joins us now to talk about her reporting. Heather, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So walk us through exactly what these companies are doing.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we found was that a bunch of different factors over the last decade or so have made the market ripe for what is essentially speculation. And for private equity, what that looks like is the company raising huge amounts of money from institutional investors, pension funds, you know, college endowments, investment banks, Wall Street, essentially, and then going out, buying a bunch of different properties, pushing to increase the income and the profit very quickly in those properties, either through rent hikes or neglecting maintenance, cutting costs, and then selling again, almost like a corporate version of a house flipper is how I described it. And that can create an environment for renters that is very challenging, obviously, if you happen to hit that building at the wrong part of the cycle.
How much of the market do these companies control?
Well, it's very hard to figure that out because there is no database that has, you know, the information on the owner. All these owners, they usually create a special LLC to hold the property. So there's no sort of national database that tells us how many units that every player has. What we have been able to look at is a wonderful survey done by the National Multifamily Housing Council, where they look at the top 50 owners. Which I believe the top 50 owners are about 10% of the market. And what we found looking at those is for the top 35, a decade ago, about a third of those owners were backed by private equity. And then in 2021, it was a little more than half. So there's been an expansion that we were able to document through that survey.
Now, Greystar is one of the companies you investigated. Here's their CEO, Bob Faith, at a conference back in 2010.
Many times we take over an asset that perhaps was, managed by a smaller organization that hadn't been focused on the bottom line. We can drive dramatic savings out of the expense side of the equation, even in a flat or even slightly declining market.
Now, Greystar didn't make Faith available for an interview for your story, Heather, but here's part of a statement they sent to ProPublica. Quote, resident satisfaction is very important to us, and we regularly survey our residents to gauge their level of satisfaction to help us address issues and identify opportunities to make improvements in our services, end quote. Heather, what did tenants tell you happened after Greystar took over as landlord?
Well, you know, I talked to tenants who lived in a building where there had been a real estate investment trust called Monogram, which was a landlord before that had opened the building. And tenants said they had a very good relationship with that landlord, with the employees of that landlord, who I guess the employees were encouraged to live in the building, and they were very responsive. It was a very nice community. Apparently, when Greystar came in and took the building over around 2017, the tenants who I talked to told me they saw very marked differences in the relationship between the management and tenants. What they found were very steep rent increases for some tenants. They found there was neglect of some of the cleanliness of the common space. They said a lot of, they had this very nice roof deck, and everything was sort of in disrepair and in disarray and not as clean. And there was a trash valet service of some sort that they were locking up the dumpster on the weekends, and so people were leaving trash in the hallways. There was concerns about security. There was a security guard who was there less often, and this was a part of the city that had sort of a lot of people kind of wandering in off the street. And so they were, making their way even up to the roof. And one tenant told me she wouldn't let her daughter up there because she saw strangers hiding behind the planters. Mm-hmm. And they said it was a very felt very different to them. And in a lot of cases, or at least the people I talked to, it got to a point where they couldn't afford it, and it was as well as being unpleasant, and they were felt essentially forced out.
We got this email from Deb who says, I am a mom and pop landlord renting a two-family house that I used to live in. I get about 5 phone calls a day from venture capital firms or hedge funds, probably based all over the world, who say they want to buy my house. I think these institutional investors are destroying the housing market, the rental market, and by extension, our neighborhoods. How do we deal with these giants that gobble everything up? Jenny, first, why does this market shift away from smaller mom and pop landlords toward bigger entities matter for tenants?
It may or may not matter that the owner of the building is a large corporation. So most people don't care who owns the building. They care about the quality of the rental experience provided. And we know that there are big corporations that have owned rental real estate for years and have been good landlords. The difference is really that traditionally the big corporate landlords have been real estate companies. This is their long-term business. They own the property for 20 or 30 years. They want to have stable tenants. They want to have the building in good condition. They're interested in the long-term returns for the building. What we're seeing now is that private equity firms are really more interested in the short-term returns. So they're interested in cutting expenses, raising rents, maximizing their returns over the next 3 to 5 years, and not necessarily thinking about the long-term. That's what seems to be putting pressure on rents going up and maybe cutting corners on things like maintenance. So, you know, it's very hard to get private equity and global capital out of the rental market. It's just not feasible to stop them from buying buildings. But what we can do is make sure that existing laws about providing good quality housing, providing responsive maintenance to tenants, and not having abusive behavior, those are already laws on the books, and we just need to make sure that those are enforced consistently.
If Heather's reporting is any indication, they aren't being enforced, or at least being enforced quickly. Heather, what did you find in your story?
I mean, I think that it's really a patchwork. It really depends on where you live, what the local laws are. And one of the concerns that one of the researchers I spoke with has is that in some of the local markets, these big companies, when they come in, and they may not have a huge market share, but they do have big political power because they have very deep pockets. And so they are able to essentially shape regulation in a manner that prevents them from being held accountable for some of these issues.
Where is the money coming from for these big investments?
Well, it's coming from again, some of these big Wall Street pots of money. It can be pension funds. It can be the college endowments. There's a big controversy here in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, and I guess in a wider area throughout Brooklyn, over a private equity coming in that actually has an investment from the Texas Permanent School Fund, I believe it's called. It's a, I think it was created by the legislature in Texas just to raise money through investments for public schools in Texas. So, you know, you've got retirees, you've got school children who are benefiting. It's a very complex problem in a lot of ways.
How does this fit into Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae's purported mission to improve housing affordability?
Well, there's a number of housing advocates who have said that what they really think are needed are some basic protections for tenants. And again, since it's something of a patchwork across the country in terms of local and state laws, Freddie Mac is doing a huge amount of the multifamily financing, and the tenants are asking, or the housing advocates are asking Freddie to consider building some tenant protections into their financing. What I found was that Freddie Mac had done a huge amount of the biggest deals being done with some of the big private equity firms over the last decade or so. And I think what they're hearing now from people, is a desire to perhaps use that financing as, the sort of cheaper, more available financing as a kind of a lever to help build some protections against, overly aggressive evictions and some other, issues with rents and keeping sort of a fair treatment of tenants at the forefront. Mm-hmm. During this financing, which is, you know, government-backed, essentially.
Jenny, what are the top things you think government should be doing right now to address the lack of affordable housing?
Well, at the federal level, providing more subsidy to low-income renters is just critical. The federal government is the only entity with deep enough pockets to really cover all of the poor households. Our housing systems are set up right now, so it's essentially a lottery system. Only about 1 in 4 low-income households gets any kind of federal assistance. The Build Back Better plan has a bunch of additional pots of money to expand existing subsidies, and it would be great to see that happen. We're going to need to see more efforts by state governments and local governments to make it easier to build apartments so that there are more apartments in better condition, tenants have more options to choose from, and landlords don't have as much market power. I think one area that might be interesting to deal with some of the corporate landlords, particularly the very large ones that cross state lines, typically regulating landlords is done by state governments, but you could make an argument that something like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has a role to play, at least in monitoring these very large multi-state actors, for instance, keeping a database of tenant complaints, doing some investigations when they get a significant number of complaints against a single company, making it more transparent so that cities know who their big landlords are and are able to keep tabs on them and make sure that they're being good actors.
That's Jenny Schutz. She's a senior fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Also with us, ProPublica reporter Heather Vogel. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.